Well, it's that time of the week again for Mining Web Weekly with Peter Major of Modern Corporate Solutions. Never a dull moment in the mining sector, is there, Peter? I had a lengthy discussion this week with Graham Soden, the chief executive of Steenkamp's Kraal. You've been rabbiting on about Steenkamp's Kraal for a while, so I thought about time that I had a discussion with him. And actually, it's going to be our director's cut tomorrow night. Very, very interesting. And that's all to do with rare earths. And I'd like us to get into some detail on that in a moment. But let's kick off with the big story of the moment. And that is gold, silver, Bitcoin have had a bit of a bad run. Is it over? Is the boom ended?
You know what? I would be tempted to say yes more than I would be tempted to say no. And I know history doesn't repeat itself 100%, but we know it rhymes very well. And if you look at the way these precious metals and Bitcoin shot up this time, Alec, they bear a huge resemblance to what we saw in the 70s. In other words, in the 70s, you had a real structural shift in the world. You know, the Arabs had nationalized most of the oil. South America and Africa had nationalized most of the copper production. So you had seismic shifts in the 70s. And the U.S. had been spending money and money that they didn't have. And everybody pretended gold was frozen at 35 an ounce until the French started draining so much out of the U.S. Federal Reserve that woke everybody up to reality. And so all the commodities ran, but especially oil, gold, and maybe a couple others, until they found their natural level. And I think we saw a lot of that this decade. Gold shot up a lot in the new millennium. It had to catch up because it had fallen too far relative to the inflation and currency devaluation and the money printing. But it kind of found a happy medium there around 2015, 2016, maybe 2017. It got revitalized during COVID, and then it went flat for about 3, 4 years, 5 years. But the way it just shot up, the way Bitcoin just shot up, unprecedented levels, and we had all these magnificent reasons why. But I think now those reasons they're all dissipated into the market. And people are comparing, hey, I've got gold at 4,000. I made a ton of money on it. Should I shift that money into something else? Should I just take some profits? You know, do I really think it's going to go up another 100% or 50%? And we know what the benchmark is. Ask Warren Buffett. The benchmark is the S&P 500, right? For 100 years, probably been the safest investment outside of government bonds, and 11% nominal terms. And what is that, about 7.5% real terms? And so you got to say, gold has run this much. Bitcoin's run this much. Am I being too cautious putting that into an index fund, putting it into a government bond, putting it into cash? So, yeah, I think they have peaked, Alec. I think they've peaked for the foreseeable future. And I'm still half fund manager. So the foreseeable future is 3 to 5 years, depending if you're Oasis, Old Mutual, or Allen Gray. Because I think those three went between a 3-year IRR, a 4-year IRR, and a 5-year IRR. And at my age, I'm more inclined to stick with a 3-year IRR. And so I certainly think it's peaked for the next 3 years. But hey, Major can be wrong easier than anybody else.
That makes a lot of sense. That's a pretty rational way of looking at it. It played catch up for a period of time. Now it's peaked in US dollar terms. But I guess for South Africans, you have to have a look at the rand element as well. And the rand has been really strong, unusually so, for a period of time. Yeah. If one has a look on the longer term, one of the best investments I remember discussing with you and David Melville, who's a big gold proponent, has been Kruger Rands.
Yeah. They've done fabulous because the rand, I think, has averaged 5.5% depreciation per annum for the last 40 years, 50 years. So that's kind of locked in. And then you can say, oh, well, what's the gold price average for that same period of time? I don't know off the top of my head, but let's say 8-9%, maybe 10. So yeah, add in the rand appreciation with the gold price appreciation. And for a safe, dull, boring investment, people holding Kruger Rands have done okay, boy. They've done really okay. And they'll probably do okay going forward.
And that's the right kind of investment to have if you're a long-term investor. Safe, dull, the kind of stuff Warren Buffett likes. He doesn't want to shoot the lights out in 1 year. He wants to have slow and steady, and he's the best investor in the world as a consequence.
Well, remember the formula that Bernie Madoff was using to attract so much money, Alec? Is, okay, because he was manufacturing his results, I don't think he ever did a double-digit year. And that was one of the things that tipped people off. Likewise, I don't think he ever did worse than 7.5%. So he never cracked 10, but he never did worse than 7.5. So he was marketing himself and all his, what do we call it, his middlemen, they were marketing and saying, guys, Bernie will give you steady returns no matter what. Market crashes, you'll still get 7.5. The market flies, you're only going to get 9. But just think, guys, if you can borrow money at 4 and 5, you can gear up. And that's how people were buying Bernie Madoff, and that's how he was marketing it. He just said, I am so steady, go out there and borrow money because I will give you 7.5, 8. You borrow at 4 or 5, and that's what the people were doing. They were borrowing money and playing the geared play on something they were very sure of, because you don't want to borrow money on something that's volatile. You can get wiped out real easy. Well, we know those returns weren't true. And to borrow money and buy cash, or to borrow money and buy government bonds, the margin's kind of too small.
So gold in US dollars might be fragile, but gold in rands, i.e. Kruger rands, that's okay. There's
much less fragile, much less volatile, 100%.
Any particular reason why the gold market might do something different? Is there... There's geopolitics, there's all kinds of tension around the world. Would you have that as one of the risk issues?
Ali, people always say you got to keep 10, 15% gold just as a backup, you know, in case there's another Holocaust or another Cold War that spreads too far, or another banking crisis, you know, grand financial crisis. I inadvertently probably had about 7%, 7.5% of my assets in gold, hard gold, you know, the coins, or bullion, bricks. And I'm combining with silver. So my silver and gold was probably between 7-8% inadvertently. I didn't have a conscious decision to do that. I just, whenever I got a chance, whenever I saw gold or wanted to help somebody out and he was in a bind, it really helped me out this year. I had a lot of things that didn't pull through this year. I had a lot of expenses this year on children that I thought were too cheap not to support, like a gold mine and a silver mine that we had obtained at prices much, much lower than we've seen the last 5 years. So I was selling my hard gold bullion and silver to put into these mines that hadn't appreciated, whereas my bullion, as we know, silver had appreciated from 18 to 50, and my gold had appreciated, geez, when I'd gotten it, some of it I got at 500, some at 1,000. So yeah, all of a sudden, it really did help me out. That 7-8% that went straight into the other two operations. So I was kind of recycling the high end of gold and putting it into an operation. And funny enough, both operations, the last month, Alec, have almost doubled in value. And I know it's a fluke, it's ironic, but taking that hard bullion that people say you always got to have under your mattress or in the backyard. So I'm a proponent of that. Yeah, I think no matter what, you can easily justify 10% of your assets in hard bullion.
But that's also telling us that you need to be wide open and wide awake and not putting your money into expensive assets, but giving them to those that you understand and that will not necessarily revalue aggressively today, but into the future, you can be reasonably confident they will.
Yeah, that's. I think you said it very well. Yeah, for the layman, for the average person out there, which is probably 99%, you know, most people don't have time to sit at their screen all day, be on the phone and read research. That's the job of a full-time analyst and fund manager. And that's why people have a right to expect alpha, outperformance. That's all they're doing, and you're paying them money. And if they're not giving you alpha or outperformance, then that means you're having to stress and you're having to watch that yourself. So, and what you said is, it's very true. You do have to pay a fair amount of attention, not every day, not even every week, but you got to read the papers, watch a newspaper, be on MoneyWeb, and say, what's going out of the normal standard deviation? What's really deviated from the mean? And a little bit doesn't matter, but when things start going a standard deviation out, let alone 1.5 standard deviations, those are serious sirens and flashing yellow lights, blue lights even.
I hope you can.
That means do something.
I hope you can also be on Biz News, not just MoneyWeb. You know, it's so funny. I did too good a job there in my first 15 years of building that business. You still think of it as ours now. But let's move on to something that is exciting. The Steenkamp Kraal operation. Talking to Graham Soden, and what was interesting to me was his dad was an Anglo-American. And so he knew how how Anglo rolled, if you like. And he saw that when Anglo did something, they did it well. They did it properly. So they got into Steenkamp Kraal and they did their research properly, even though they released the asset in the 60s because rare earths were no longer valuable. The fact was they still got the data, the numbers, the assaying was still accurate. It just explained how that works. Has that stuff not changed much over the decades?
Not at all, Alec. Graham's 100% right on that. A client of mine in 2004 brought me a uranium project that Anglo-American had north of Springbok in the 70s. And you probably don't remember this as well as I do, but in the 1970s, South Africa had two international airports. They had Jan Smuts and they had Springbok. So a lot of international players, they landed at Johannesburg, they got off the plane, they got onto an airplane, they flew directly to Springbok. Things were happening in the Northern Cape in the 70s. All the big internationals were there. Uranium was going nuts, rare earths, thorium, copper, base metals. You know, Phelps Dodge found that magnificent Black Mountain deposit. Spin-off of that was Hamsburg. So, yes, a client brought me in 2004 a uranium project, not dissimilar from Steenkamp Kraal. Uranium, Anglo's, I got the bankable feasibility study from Anglo-American. It is leather-bound. I've taken it to people, the Viljoen brothers, the twins. They came in and drooled over it and took pictures because we all remembered this is how Anglos operated then. And you're, Alec, that data is impeccable. And funny enough, we've got older data from O'Keeffe Copper. We've even got geophysical data from the 40s and the 50s. And do you know what our geophysicist tells us? Pete, it's as valid as if you fly over today in a drone, a helicopter, or a hot air balloon. That data is data. It will last 1,000 years. It doesn't change. It tells you just as much information today, how you interpret it, how you model it, you know, artificial intelligence, algorithms. That's the key. But that old data, it is invaluable. Whatever they spent on it, it's worth multiples today. And so Graham's right on that. The data is valuable, and Anglos, they might not quite balance out to a 43-101 Canadian standard or a JORC, but anybody that sees and believes it's genuine Anglo's data, they accept it like that. They drill maybe one out of 50 holes just to confirm it. So there were a few projects Anglos did that they turned over. And it wasn't just Anglos. I've got Goldfields data, similar story, magnificent. Just read the junior reports. The way the juniors wrote a report, you could see there were serious graybeards overseeing how everybody wrote any kind of report. But the numbers, they don't age a bit.
Is that because, well, geology is geology. That doesn't change. It's been there for millions of years.
That's exactly why. Yeah. So if you got a percentage, if you drilled a hole and that thing was 3.5% copper, it's probably not going to alter very much in 1,000 years.
Isn't that interesting? Well, Steenkamp's Kraal is a very exciting deposit. Certainly its time appears to have come. I suppose what we've got to worry about is whether its time is going to be a little bit like gold. It's done a catch-up and then doesn't come anymore. So where are we with rare earths, Peter?
Well, some of the information I read on Steenkamp's Kraal could be a little dated because they converted the price of rare earths into the gold price. And then they work backwards to get the grade. And so the document I read, Alex, said the grade is equivalent to a 90 gram per ton gold price. And I think Harmony is averaging, what, 5 grams a ton, six? So that's 15 times Harmony's grade.
But not gold. Obviously not gold. It's something else.
It's rare earths. And you say, if we add up the value of rare earths, because they are quite high, they're not as high as they've been, and they've come back a little lately, I'd say they're 50% above their mean. And they were double their mean a few years ago. So they're about 50%. They're halfway up there, kind of like the PGM price right now, not quite 40% above its mean. So those are good prices. So yes, Steenkamp's Kraal, very rich, arguably the richest rare earths in the world. And 100 years ago, you could have really translated that into some money. But this is 2025. We have ESG. We have all kinds of standards, whether it's a JORC standard, an environmental standard, if it's Gwedimontasha standard, and you've got the nuclear radiation authority here. You have a lot of departments that have to okay your mining, including medical. How long can your miners be underground? Some people say they can only be underground 4 hours a day, 5 days a week. Others say, no, they can work 8 hours a day every other day. So these are all moving targets, Alec. And these are targets that people didn't have 100 years ago. If you found something high grade, you could mine it today, sell it tomorrow, and bank the profit. But nowadays, especially something like rare earths that does have radioactivity, there are so many departments you have to cater to. And we've talked on this program before about the biggest factor that affects your return. I think it's time. Okay, Warren Buffett says it's your entry price. So let's say they're both equally important. What is your entry price of your investment? And what is the time it takes to realize the return on that investment? So I think these are the big problems an investor would have looking at Steenkamp's Kraal, other than it's not listed. You know, if he buys in now, what valuation is he buying out? How liquid is it? Can he ever get out? Who's he going to sell to? I think it's great for the country if they help develop that mine. I think the more they can upgrade the product in this mine, that creates more and more jobs. But who's going to fund that? And if it's the government, well, the government doesn't worry about the same rate of return as we do, but they should because they're using our money. Because if government gets a good rate of return, they don't have to print money, borrow money, steal money, or sell assets. But when government squanders their money, then they have to print more, they have to klutz more, they have to sell more assets. Yeah. So who's going to invest in Steenkamp's Kraal? It's got to be somebody who has a different time horizon on the return of his money than probably you, I, or most of the viewers on your station.
So what Graham said to me in our conversation yesterday, they've got the 200 million rand from the IDC, Industrial Development Corporation. So the state has put in 200 million rand. He said, but that's just a small plant. That's the equivalent of, I think he said, about a wheelbarrow full of material every minute. So it's really not a huge operation. He says it's very, very small in a South African context. And so what they've got to do is prove the process and then to attract international investment. But if you think in the geopolitical age that we're at right now, where China and the United States are bashing heads, and the United States is wanting to do something in South Africa, joining the dots, Brent Bazell, Trump's man, should be arriving here fairly soon as the new ambassador in South Africa. He'd love nothing more than to land some kind of a coup for the U.S., for Trump to put, I don't know, $100 million into something like Steenkamp's Kraal and to be independent of Chinese rare earths indefinitely, and doesn't have to worry about it for his drones, for his electric vehicles, for his wind farms and so on. It would seem to me that there could be something there that might interest the Americans and take Steenkamp's Kraal from being a little project, given that they've got all this rich resource, into something quite exciting.
Alec, you and I can see that really clear. And if we started with a clean sheet of paper, we could do this whole transaction with the States in one day. Unfortunately, we got 30 years of pretty messed up paper, you know, very muddy water. So we have great deposits. We have Steenkamp's Kraal, we got Zamkopst Drift, and we have the Palabora dumps that George has up there. All of that the States would love to have. And had we been a little bit camaraderie with the States the last few years, I think we would have had Trump's money developing those right now. Now, it's not too late, but if we go knocking on his door saying, Don, we know you want rare earths, and we've got them, and we want to help you get them. We could use a little money. Like, remember back in the late 50s, early 60s, you guys wanted uranium. You helped us with the money. We built 31 uranium plants. You guys got it all. Hey, we want to redo that. And if we talk nice and present it correctly, hopefully we can eradicate some of the last 30 years of agro, because it would make sense for both parties, Alec. And that may be our foot in the door. You know, it may be a way of saying, can we try to make up for some of the past, do we call it insults or bad vibes? You know, we really want to make up. We want to get in your guys' good books. We'd like to get to most favored nation trade status again. We'd like to get out of the 30% tariffs. Most of all, we want to help your auto industry, because your auto industry can help ours. You know, we can bring in parts. So this is an important card, but we have to play it correctly. And yeah, we could really use U.S. investment to develop that, because when I see the money that the U.S. is throwing at other rare earths, my gosh, I think he'd get multiples bang for buck on our rare earths that he is on those others.
It makes me wonder whether Ramaphosa's not the problem. If you could eject him from the system, and he's going soon, he's going in about a year's time, where there will be another conference, which he can't stand. He won't be the president anymore. There'll be a new president. But if you could just bring in, whether it's from the ANC or from whoever, a business-focused leader in this country, man, the doors could open.
Exactly. You know, we don't care what party it is. We just care, what is he philosophizing? You know, what's his modus operandi? It doesn't matter what party. You know, we could live with an EFF if he said and did the right things. Yeah, we need somebody who aggressively wants to befriend the States to our benefit.
Create jobs. It's all about jobs. Put jobs at the top of your priorities, and suddenly everything changes, or the whole way that you look at the world changes. Because jobs need a thriving economy. A thriving economy needs investment. And you ain't getting that investment from the Chinese and the Russians, your best pals. You can only get that investment from the rich people. And that's the people up in the north. I hope that penny drops, Pete. I hope that penny drops. Because South African mining legislation would not suggest that it is dropping.
No, no, it won't. And this would give the ANC a way out. Because we know they don't ever want to be seen to be backing up. They don't ever want to be seen to have made a mistake. But we've kind of seen it with them bending their B policy with Elon Musk on Starlink. You know, they were going to make a special BE. And I've been approached twice now about would I help with the delegation to America to propose a different kind of investment / BE. And, you know what my answer was, Alec? That is a great idea, but why do we need to do it behind the doors and under the table? Why don't we just put it in the front page of the paper? Then you don't need me running over there. You guys can do it. You know, be proud of it. Because American companies don't want to think, oh, we're getting an edge, but nobody else is. What if we get exposed? We could be accused of bribery. Just make that your open policy.
Hmm. What exactly were they saying to you there, Pete? What do they want you to do?
Get a round table of the largest American mining companies and tell them that there's a potential of doing a Starlink type deal, whereas they don't quite have to have the same implementation of BEE that everybody else does. But yeah, I said, guys, they'll throw it in my face. You know, if I went there with Cyril on my left and Gwede, maybe they'd listen, but I doubt it. They'd still say, why don't you just make it for everybody? Look, if you want to say we're going to just do this for the States, okay, you know, maybe it's worth it. But it's like, I don't want to be a probe out there if I'm not sure there's commitment behind me. You know, are they sending me out there as a sacrificial lamb and then they deny that they ever had anything to do with it? You know, I'm pretty expendable, you know. I don't want to be, but yeah. The fact is, it shows they're thinking, wow, could we get more investment if we backed off on the BE requirement? Yes, you could. And you could get more investment if you accelerated the cadastra implementation instead of saying we're going to test it in the Western Cape for a year or two. Is that to give everybody north of the Western Cape time to clean up all the nefarious activities they've been doing at the DMR or get all their buddies one last shot? You know, announce a bold decision and implement it simultaneously.
I think you told us that they had a cadastra type operation into the north of us, which was implemented by a South African company very quickly. And yet we're still dragging our heels on this one.
Yeah, for the last 20 years, half of Africa has been using a South African Cape Town designed, built, implemented cadastra system very successfully. Low cost, simple. Everybody uses it. Even I can go in and use it. Sitting here, I can go to any African country that has that system, go in, and I can even find my way around, Alec. And I am a real klutz on anything like that. So, yeah, for 20-some years, it's been implemented north of us. But that didn't serve the prerogative of those in charge. They didn't want a simple, clear, easy to use, hard to mess up, and corrupt system. They had work to do. Funny business. Monkey
business.
Well,
it's quite interesting what's coming out of the Madlanga Commission and at the Ad Hoc Committee at Parliament and this whole turf war in the SAPS and the politicians who are involved. And you're getting a glimmer of hope that there are people, or one person, the deputy minister, one of the deputy ministers, who really does want to clean things up, but the rest of them not so much. However, from the politician's perspective, a lot of our politicians there are kind of getting on. You know, Ramaphosa's in his 70s. Gwede Mantashe's not looking that. He doesn't look terribly healthy. I think he's in his 70s as well. Now they've got to be looking at legacy. And their legacy as it stands is going to be shocking. It's going to be shocking. It's going to be, I stood in the way of people in the same way as you look at Thabo Mbeki, and his legacy is, I killed 300,000 people at least by not giving them HIV AIDS medicine because I said they must have beetroots. I think that you're looking at a similar legacy here. I stopped people from getting an opportunity of getting a job because of my bloody mindedness that I was demanding that it's our turn to eat. It's our turn as the caterers to eat, even though that was proven to be a very, very poor approach to growing an economy. And you don't really need more evidence to it. Are you seeing those glimmers, or am I Mr. Optimist on my own?
No, I'll tell you what I'm seeing. Yeah, I'm seeing glimmers because I'm seeing the status quo cracking. And I'm seeing the glimmers of light coming through the various cracks. Now, I don't know if there's a force on the other side of those cracks, or those cracks are just self-imposed. As you said, it's infighting, and it's pressures from inside and pressures from outside that they're leading to it. But yeah, how many leaders have we had, Alec? What kind of legacy? I think Mr. Mandela, couple legacies. He can say, I got everybody in this country the right to vote. Anybody who wanted to vote could vote. They could live anywhere they wanted. They could do anything they wanted within the law. I think that's a good legacy. And he presided over the dropping of sanctions. He presided over some foreign investment. So I think he's got three good legacies. Then we go on to Thabo Mbeki. Did investment increase when Thabo was president? Was the legislation, certainly in mining, it wasn't improved. He nationalized the mines, implemented BEE, the arms deal. You know, I don't know, you know, 300,000 men lost their jobs in mining. Do we attribute that to Thabo or the two union leaders, Cyril and Gwede? So then we move up from Zuma. Well, we know what his legacy is. It's actually destruction on all counts. You know, it was gross state capture, flat out. Flat out, every institution was corrupted. And you don't uncorrupt an institution by just changing the person at the top. You know, it's you got cancer, you don't just change your diet and the cancer goes away. Or you got polio, AIDS, whatever. You know, you don't just change what you eat and it goes away. It takes a lot of work. So now we come from Mr. Zuma to Cyril. Cyril, what is your legacy?
Not a bright one at the moment anyway, but he could do it. He could. He's still got time to turn it around. He's still got time to, because the Chinese, yep, they're dealing with Trump. They've struck a deal with him. Whereas South Africa is now, I don't know, it'll be us and Iran and Venezuela maybe. Who are out on us, and Russia, of course.
We are frozen in the headlights. We don't know what to do. We don't know which direction to go. And we're just going to get hit by a train. We can't even get out of the railroad tracks.
I wanted to show you a presentation that was, well, part of a presentation that came through from the Minerals Council, Mzila Mtenyani, who does a pretty good job there. But this is the total mining input costs. And the concern was that they grew 2.5% year on year. I don't know, Pete. Help me out here. 2.5% seems small, but if you go back here, back to 2014, so there's 10 years that this graph is showing, that we have these big ramp-ups and then significant declines. In fact, there was deflation in mining costs a few months ago, not long ago. What do we make of this, and does it make South Africa a good mining destination outside of all the legislative nonsense?
Alec, when I saw this graph, I thought, hey, that looks pretty good. It's much lower than I would have thought. It shows this country has amongst the lowest inflation of most countries in the world today, if I interpret this graph correctly. And when I see 2.5% year-on-year change in costs, geez, if that isn't mining, I'd be patting everybody on the back, everybody. CEOs all the way down to the lowest ditch diggers, and I'd be giving them a bonus. But I can't believe this number. It looks too good to be true. So I tried reading the commentary that went with this, and I got very confused, and I read it twice. And I'm not sure if they're trying to say it was month on month 2.5%, which is be shocking. But year on year, 2.5%, as you said, I think that's fantastic. I don't think many industries on this planet can show 2.5% increase per year. So I'm going to leave it at that. I don't. And as you can see, back in 21, 22 with COVID, we had double digit increases. You know, that was mining going to the wall, but it wasn't going to the wall because you had insane metal prices jump up then. And that's what always happens. That's what's happening to the world's gold industry now. When you have insane product price increases, it's quickly followed by pretty bad cost increases. And that's a manager's toughest job, is to control costs when his revenue is running away. Because everybody's happy, everybody's making money, and they say, back off, chill out, Dad. You know, why are you being so strict on us? It's a lot easier cutting costs and controlling costs when the product price is falling, revenue is decreasing. Everybody realizes the ship is taking on water and we don't want it to go down. So everybody helps. But yeah, those cost increases to me, they look too good to be true.
So if you are a mine manager at a gold mine and you've seen the gold price come back in the last little while, are you now going to say, okay, let's redouble. Let's have those meetings where we check all the costs and make sure that we get our costs under control because storm winds could be coming.
Without a doubt, Alec. Yeah. And look, that cost increase went up so fast. Sorry, the revenue increase in gold. It was literally, what, 3 or 4 months? We saw it go from, in fact, it was 2 months. I think it went from 3,300 to 4,300. So, but believe me, the people that charge you, your suppliers, your laborers start goofing off more. They start wasting more. And definitely your suppliers, they're really quick. Oh boy, they're the canary in the birdcage, your suppliers. All of a sudden, you're getting rock bolts, cables. They go, hey, sorry, man, our costs are 15, 20% up. Yeah, we just got hit with this. So normally you have a reset. Remember, America's auto industry used to be so powerful. And they'd have a couple of good years, and those costs would go out. And boy, you'd get in. Vice President of Purchasing was the most powerful person in the big auto companies. And they would just call in all the suppliers and say, guys, you're going to take a 30% haircut, flat out. You know, that was their reset. Not we're going to taper off your increase. And guys, geez, 30% haircut, that's extreme unction. You know, that's 30% will die. And they said, well, die somewhere else. You're not going to die on my property. And the guys would do it because those suppliers would then go to their people, their laborers and who they got the material from. And it would work down and maybe they'd negotiate, hey, we can't do 30, but we can do 23 and we'll give you another 4. But it's brutal, but man, it's fast. And I don't know that we're quite out of control yet, but I just see gold fields. All of a sudden they're bringing on resources that were not resources before because the gold price is higher. But they say, we need $2,000 an ounce to mine this, not $1,500 an ounce. So they're revaluing their resources, which is okay if gold keeps going up, but if gold goes down far enough, pretty soon they don't really have those resources. They don't really have those ounces because they're totally uneconomic. So gold analysts got to keep abreast. And fund managers that are buying gold shares, they got to keep abreast of this because what are your assets being valued at? What are your resources and reserves being valued at? But yeah, it's the suppliers first. I've just talked to, pretty big employer in formerly the Northern Transvaal, north of Gauteng. And he says, wouldn't believe who's on my side when I've got unruly employees, Peter. Can you believe it is a union called AMCU? And he said, all I have to do is mention it to senior management. They come, they call a caucus, and they sort out my employees. So, and this is AMCU. We all know what their history was, right? They had to be more radical than anybody else. So I would say took a lot of work, but our unions are very mature and in line with the economic status of this country. They're disconnected from government as much as normal business is. They're much more business-oriented and job-oriented and labor-oriented. Yeah, what's good for the laborers long-term?
But then you got to hope that at some point in time, one of those guys puts their hand up and says, okay, let me show these politicians how to run a country. Let me go and stand for the people who are increasingly becoming unemployed, for those former members of mine who we've just had to cave in on and let their jobs go. Let me go and take on an approach which will grow employment. And really, it's not that difficult. It's not that difficult at all. Just get the ideology out of the way. The world is, especially with Trump in the White House, the world is ready. It's ready to invest here, and then you'll get the ideologists, ideologues telling you, yeah, but at what cost? Well, at the cost of hungry stomachs, I would say.
I would say a lot of our current union leaders are much more plugged in to the realities of life and business than our politicians. They are in ivory towers because they never want for anything. Alec, can you imagine being in the senior levels of government? You have infinite money. You can print as much as you want. You can borrow as much as you want. All the country's assets are at your desire. They're at your fingertips. You can sell them, borrow them, rent them. You can barter them, trade them for foreign favors. You know, it is another world. It's not the real world that 90-some percent of the population live in. You know, every penny we make, we have to earn, negotiate. And yeah, they just have unlimited sources of income, unlimited sources of power. So I think they're all, certainly 90% of them are too far removed to be doing this country and the average person here any good.
Peter Major from Modern Corporate Solutions. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com. And that was our Mining Web Weekly. Till the next time, cheerio.